Welcome to the Wasatch Hills Church Podcast, a ministry of the Wasatch Hills Seventh-day Adventist Church with Pastor Bernie Anderson. Our prayer is that what you hear will inspire, equip, and perhaps introduce you to a new walk with Jesus Christ.
I don't know how many of you have heard of a comedian named Brian Regan. He's kind of a goofy guy. And so anything that I'm going to try and say of his, I won't be able to say in his manner. But it just seems like a fitting start to the story that I have for you today. He tells of being in a line waiting at the airport because his bags were lost. So he's trying to figure out what he's going to do if his bag's gone, and the people promise him that they're going to get him his bags in the future. But in the meantime, they slide across the counter a little black bag like this. For those of you who have ever gotten one, you know what I'm talking about. But he says, I picked up the bag, and on it says, Essentials Kit. He says, oh, these are my essentials. Then I overpacked. I thought my essentials were all those things I meticulously packed in my suitcase. But he says, an essentials kit. Isn't that kind of a weird phrasing for this? He says, can't you just picture somebody showing up at work one day and being like, hey, where's Bob? And he's like, oh, he don't need us. He happened upon an essentials kit. He was filled with food, shelter, and love. I think a lot of times we're hoping for an essentials kit. Like things happen and you're standing in line for something, and maybe it's not a literal line. You're thinking, what is going on in our world? Maybe literally, maybe it's just in the things that you're facing. But I know when I look back at the stories that I remember from my life, I can definitely see a lot of those times when I just kept thinking, why, you know? Losing your bags, it's like, why me? There's like a million flights today, and there's like 17 bags lost, and mine's one of them. Why? Why? And it's always on the time when you need it the most. You know, it's not like when you're heading to back home and you have all your stuff. It's always when you're heading to the place. Now you have nothing and you're supposed to maybe do a presentation the next day and you don't have your suit, that kind of stuff. It's just the way it works. And yet there's also times when you're called to do something that maybe doesn't make sense. An opposition comes and you think, well, if I was called to this, shouldn't it be easier? I think of a story that I heard recently. Maybe some of you heard it recently too. For those of you that remember a long time ago, there was an NFL football player named William Refrigerator Perry. And the reason he was nicknamed the Refrigerator was because of his size. He was a refrigerator. Defensive lineman, very huge, helped win Super Bowl for the Chicago Bears. Well, in recent times, he has fallen on hard times, and most recently, a series of severe medical situations forced him to, he lost everything that he had, and he ended up selling his Super Bowl ring just to pay for his own medical bills. Well, there's a young boy in Chicago who Refrigerator Perry was his hero, and he heard the story, and he really felt that his job was to get that ring back and get it back to the refrigerator. So he goes to his mom, and he says, Mom, I know that it's my job to get that, buy that ring back and give it back to Mr. Perry. And Mom says, you're going to buy back a Super Bowl ring for someone. How do you plan on getting that kind of money? And the kid looks at her and says, how about my college fund? Those of you who are parents are going, that's hilarious. Your college fund? Don't think so. But this mom was different. She thought about it and thought, do I want my child to guarantee my child the education of college or to encourage the education of him being willing to sacrifice for something he thinks is right? She says yes. So the boy tracks down the ring, buys it, returns it to Refrigerator Perry, and he, of course, is very moved at the gesture, made national news, and on some talk shows, people began to debate. People calling in said, that was absolutely ridiculous. Why would a mom ever allow that? That should never have been allowed. And other people saying, of course it should be allowed. Even after the fact, even after people saw the impact of it, still questions. Why would you do that? There's still opposition, even after the time comes. And I think about a lot of the things that happened just early on for me. when I was 8. I remember a year where I got beaten up so severely most days, but especially a number of times where I actually had to go to the hospital, at least go to the doctor, concussions, major cuts, stitches, those kinds of things. Also, my parents got divorced that year, very hard on us all. We ended up having to move into an area of extreme poverty, and over the next few years, we were in a location where there was lots of physical violence in the apartments. There was kids that would get in huge brawls in the evenings between gangs in this inner-city apartment complex. I watched a scary guy that used to throw rocks at us kids when we were playing out in the courtyard, like big rocks, river rocks. I watched him, after a fight with the manager of the apartment, shoot himself. We had drills that the parents taught us on how to avoid the child molester that lived upstairs that kept trying to kidnap us during snowball fights. What you do to make sure that you hear about that. And we lived in poverty. So I went to a school where it was high-income families. So they're going to Aspen and Vail in 2 weeks at Powell, and I am staying home. So I didn't get to take part in any of the social events, the extras that were really important. So I always, while I had a lot of friends, I also didn't have any friends at the same time. You know how that goes sometimes. You know everybody. You get along. But I remember just feeling like, why? You know, how come I'm the one that has to deal with this? What's going on? Why is it such a difficult situation? You know, we could distribute this out. Each person could have a problem this week. We'll all come together, learn from it, and all have 5 days of good. You know, make it fair. Not the way it works. But it just continued. When my mom decided to move to Colorado Springs from Denver, I knew I was leaving from where my dad was. Big court battles ensued. There was all the more money lost, so that was already a challenge. But when I got to this new location, the friends, and they were good friends, we actually grew very close, but I remember dealing with the stress of all the people that I had met there, the kids I had met around me. I had one that, partway through her second year there, ended up at 15, getting a job as a stripper at a cheap nightclub downtown. Became very anorexic, and I remember watching her go from very healthy size to being literally looking like the pictures you see from the concentration camps. Skin sucked in around her face, all this stuff, and knowing that every night she got paid a little bit of money so that guys could watch a 15-year-old anorexic girl. I had another one that became a practicing warlock, started doing the big seances and all these things that had a lot of problems that were scary for many people. I had another friend that was so hurt from his past and things happening around him that he would self-mutilate, carve things in his arms and his body, heavily addicted to drugs just to try and kind of get by. Another friend that committed suicide, whose mother committed suicide that year. That's just some of them. But I remember the weight thinking, how is this little like microcosm of life? How is this what happens, and what is it, how are any of us supposed to turn out okay? I remember thinking that at some point. Because our principal, I've told a number of stories about this principal. He was there to clean us up, and we were just a rabble, and we had to get just booted out. Why I got to stay, I'm not totally sure. I think it might have had a little something to do with that. I was dating the school board chairman's daughter. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And yet, I remember thinking, what is going on here? Where's the help? Where do we get kind of rescued from this situation? I remember then in college, I was at Walla Walla University. Well, it's Walla Walla College back then. Back in the old days. And I was a head RA of the men's dormitories. I got it because it paid well and I didn't have to do much work. No morals involved whatsoever. I didn't really care about... There's things I cared about on spirituality. I had grown a lot from when I first got to college. And yet, for the most part, I just wasn't there yet. I just saw so much pain and frustration around me. And the only reason I still bought into God at all is because of the supernatural I'd seen on the side of evil. I knew there was a power out there, and if there's a power on this side, there has to be a power on this side. It's just the way life works. And I remember there was one student in particular that just was so cheery and spiritual that it just grated on me. And if we weren't in the spiritual stuff, I could really enjoy him. It was really nice, really friendly. But when he'd get on the spiritual stuff, you know, well, my test, that wasn't me, that was Jesus. Jesus gave me the knowledge to pass this test. Ah, okay. Could have been that you studied 4 hours, I don't know. But I remember that was my reaction. One night, we'd had a fun Friday night. We show up at the dorm lobby, and we're trying to plan out what we're going to do that's actually fun now. So we finished Vespers, so now it's like, okay, now we go out and hit the town, do whatever we can. And this guy comes walking in, and it's like, hey guys, what are we going to do? Well, we know, once this guy's here, you can't do anything other than, you know, have a Bible study or something. At that point, it was like, ugh. So we decided, we all kind of had this shared look, you know, the kind of wink, wink. Like, oh, we're just going to go to bed, we're really tired. You know, just relax a little bit, maybe do little Bible studies before we go to bed. We all split up, and we knew, it's a later time, meet again, he'll be gone, then we go do have our fun. So I go down, and I'm just kind of trying to bide my time for a little while, and there's a knock on my door, and I open the door, and it's this guy. And again, when we had most of our conversations about normal stuff, I actually got along with him well, so there wasn't a bad feeling about that, but it's just, this isn't the time. This isn't time to do the spiritual thing, you know, I want to go have fun now. He knocked at my door, and he came and sat down, and he's just one of these guys that's just always cheery and happy. And he's always so faith-filled, and he's always so sure to make sure he's doing the right thing, even when the rest of us are like, not now, man. And he comes in, and I was like, oh, man, I don't get to go do this stuff tonight. I'm head RA, I can't phase him out. I got to act like I care. So I was like, hey, what are you doing? And he's like, well, I just needed to talk. Are you okay to talk? You know, since you're just going to bed anyway. And I was like, right. Since I'm going to bed anyway, we might as well talk. So he sat down on the couch in my room, and he started to get tears in his eyes. And the first thing he said is, he says, you know, I've tried so hard to be happy, to be positive, to have faith, to do all these things. And he says, but I don't feel it for real. But when I see you, I see your faith. And I see you have something in you that does carry you through, and I want that. And I remember just sitting there for a minute being like, this is very backwards. I'm trying to avoid you so I can do unspiritual things on Friday night while claiming to be an Adventist. And yet, you are, and you're the one that we had to avoid to stop doing that, and yet you're coming to me because I've got something you want because I'm the spiritual one. And I remember this kind of struggle going, do I like kind of be honest and say, oh, you've got the wrong guy, trust me? Or do I hear him out and try to help, or do I sit there in stunned silence, which is what I chose. It was kind of the easier route. So he started talking about the story of where he'd come from, the challenges that he'd faced, why he did what he did, why he said what he said, and a lot of it came from a very pivotal moment in his life where a huge, huge loss had come. And he knew that when that person in his life had died, they had a spirituality they were trying to convey to him. So the best way to honor that was to try to live it out. But if any of you have ever experienced it, trying to live out something you don't feel for the approval of someone else just doesn't work. And he's hitting that spot where it just wasn't working anymore. And he didn't know why he'd been going through the stuff he had. We ended up talking for probably 4 or 5 hours. I remember at the end, it was kind of at that point where it's just time to be done. You know, you can just sense we've talked about what we can talk about. We'd actually had a really good time, and I could see his spirits had lifted, and I had gotten a little more caring. I didn't start that way, sadly. But I remember thinking something. It's like, tell him, can we pray? And I was like, see, in my mind, I was literally thinking, I was like, see, this is the very thing that annoys me. I don't like it when I finish a conversation that has meaning and then someone says, hey, can we pray together? Yeah, and this was back due to the situations I'd been through. And that's when someone would do that, we'd have a little conversation at the end, they'd get that kind of look in their eyes. Hand on the shoulder, can I pray with you? And it's like, yes, because I'm not allowed to say no. And I have this feeling to say that. I have to decide whether I really buy that stuff or not. And I remember just thinking, all right, I'm going to do this. I have this feeling in me, this prompting in me. And so I said, can I pray with you before you go? And he just was like, yes, that would be so good. And I was like, okay. So we knelt down, and out of habit, at that point, I wasn't the prayer guy, right? When we pray, they're the ones praying. They're like, hey, can I pray with you? And then they pray. So we're sitting there in silence for a moment, and it's not until, you know, like 5 seconds into the awkward silence that I'm like, oh, right, me. Right. I'm the one praying for him. And so I just didn't know what to say, so I started with the normal stuff, you know, be with us, thank you for everything you've done for us, be with him. And then there was a point where I started praying for what he told me about, like the actual stuff. And I remember feeling the room just zoom out. I felt like we were still in the same spots, but all of a sudden there was no walls, no space. And the weird thing was, it was actually a panicky feeling. You know, I've always heard these warm, fuzzy feelings about these spiritual moments. Mine, it was actually a feeling of tininess, as everything sucks away, and just there's just this expanse around. And when he left then, the prayer was by far the longest prayer I'd ever prayed. And at the end, he had tears in his eyes, and he left. And as I sat there for a long time after, thinking through what just happened, I remember the main thing I kept thinking is that regardless of what I think I believe or think I'm putting across, my experiments, that's probably true too, my experiences have placed something in me that now is relating to people. I wasn't trying to relate anything, and yet there's something in me that he resonated with. Without me even wanting to send off that vibe, something had made him feel that it was time. He'd had a prompting. The idea that God will actually send you to a place for a reason. Stick a thought or a feeling in your heart. Go talk to him. For me to say, hey, pray for him. And you have this opportunity to listen or to not listen. And it's interesting because it's something that kind of seems obvious in a way. I mean, we talk about it a lot. But I was just looking at this in a new light last night as I was studying. And some of you may have looked at the sermon title. Many of you probably haven't. That's okay. But if you did, it's Joseph and Jezebel. What do those two have to do with each other at all? Very good question. I had the same question when I sent out that was my sermon title. So I investigated both so that I could follow through on what I said I was going to talk about. It's interesting. Jezebel is in Kings. And the story I remember of Jezebel is the rough ending. And I remember the showdown at Carmel and how then she scares Elijah away after he just had this victory. What I didn't realize is that she's actually introduced, I believe it's 1 Kings 16, and she has times where she's mentioned off and on all the way till 2 Kings chapter 9. And the first thing I noticed as I was studying this is just the sheer amount of space that the non-king took up in the Book of the Kings. Like, this is over hundreds and hundreds of years, if I understand right. King after 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 king. And she takes up, not every minute, but is inserted in the story for one third of the distance between the beginning of 1 Kings and the end of 2 Kings. That is a lot of space for a person who's not even a king to be put in the Book of the Kings. Why? What's the story in there? What is it that's even happening? Joseph, you have a story that begins with God deciding to create the world. And then the whole story of creation, of everything that happens, all the way up until Moses. 50 chapters of knowledge expanding hundreds of years. Joseph, 14 of those chapters. 14 chapters. It's almost a third. So they each take up a third. And so To me, pattern man, there's a pattern, something I can talk about here. But the interesting thing is, to me, they're direct. It's like a mirror image. It's more like a negative, you know? You take the negative, and there's one side that looks normal, and the other one's like the black and the white, and everything's opposite, and it looks kind of creepy. To me, that's the story of Joseph and Jezebel. If you ever thought about the way Joseph's story happens, he has all these huge miracles. What is most of the story about, though? It's his misery, right? It's like, Joseph did this, and then look at all this bad stuff that happened. Let's talk about it. And then this thing happened. And then here's this. You know, it's like the volume of time is spent on the bad things that are happening. Things that could be taken as signs that God's not with you, man. Give up. Life's not fun right now. And the interesting thing is his character. And I'm going to do a very, at least in my experience from the story of Joseph, I'm going to do something that's very, very unique. And I'm going to actually put out there that Joseph maybe wasn't actually a jerk at the beginning. I've never heard the Joseph story told without someone starting off saying, man, he was this snotty little kid at the beginning that just made them so angry at him because he was so obnoxious and over, you know, cocky and in their face that they had to get rid of him. I'm not convinced that that's true. Now, the dad, yes, he definitely caused his problems. It's very clear that he spoiled him. He favored him. That's true. And we know what most kids who have parents like that are like. I'm a teacher, I know. None of them here, just outside here. But when you look at the significance of dreams, anytime it comes up in the Old Testament, when you look at the significance of dreams in the historical culture, not only in Israel, but in the other surrounding nations, dreams were a message from God to be relayed to the people. They're prophetic messages that had to be relayed because it's the communication between God and man. There's not prophets yet. We don't have Elijah running around coming to Joseph and being like, hey, here's what you're going to do. So Joseph is given a dream. And in that context, in that culture, you have to tell people. It doesn't say he did it with bad spirit. It doesn't do anything. I read through it like 5 times last night to make sure I wasn't digging my hole for myself right now. Not that I'm not, but at least I couldn't find it. But as it talks about what Joseph did, it says that his brothers hated him and never could say a kind word to him because of the father's love for him, before it even says anything that Joseph said. It says Joseph gave a bad report about them. Well, if you read their story, not just the Joseph part, but the other things that are inserted, that are just the brothers, they were bad guys. So if he's giving a bad report, it might have been very well that he had reason to, and he was doing the thing that required integrity, standing up to an evil that had just happened and reporting it. It never says he rubs anything. He just tells them the dream. They interpret it accurately, by the way. They just don't like the accurate interpretation. Even dad gets mad because they know what it means. And they know that dreams are supposed to be a message from God. So they're mad because they're saying, you're telling us you're going to be king. Well, it came in a dream and I'm supposed to tell you. So we actually don't know that Joseph was this rude, obnoxious, entitled kid. He might have been. But we don't know that. And the interesting thing is, from the very moment he just travels to Egypt, sold to Potiphar, and at that moment he is already picture perfect from then on. Respectful, positive, God-filled, never making an error in character from then on. Did that happen on the slave journey over? Maybe. That's a crisis you'd have to deal with. Or maybe he really had built in to him from much earlier a character. Maybe God had trained him enough to where he felt he was ready for all of this. If Joseph hadn't told those dreams, he wouldn't have been, at least in terms of the chain in the story, we don't know that he would have been thrown into the pit at the time when the Ishmaelites were coming by, that he would have been saved and taken to Egypt rather than killed like they wanted. We don't know that that would have happened. It may have been that God needed to give those dreams because he was going to get killed, and at least this way the timing worked to where the Ishmaelites would come by. So just a thought. Maybe Joseph actually chose right even from the beginning. But then what happens is we see whatever he's doing, he gets thrown in a pit, sold into slavery. We know that's too far. We know it's quite an injustice that's going to last the rest of your life, at least in his mind. What a terrible thing to overcome. Can you imagine? Can you imagine if right now you got taken and sold into slavery in another country, they stuck you on a ship, took you over somewhere? I think I'd have a little question about how much God's taking care of me. But he instantly does everything to the best of his ability. And it says that God is not only with him in everything he did, but that the entire household was blessed because of him. Didn't matter what they were believing. They were worshiping a whole other set of gods. They could be doing immoral things or not. Potiphar's wife, her possessions are exploding and being blessed because of this. And we know she's not doing good things. And yet, another problem comes. He stands for what's right, thrown into prison. 2 years in prison. He does what's right. He gets moved up there and gets all this freedom, takes care of stuff, predicts a dream accurately for the people, and especially for the one guy, gives him hope, and he's then mentally prepared to get taken back to the palace. Oh, but forgotten again. Hope, you're going back to Pharaoh, tell him about me. Nothing. But then, a happy ending, rises to full power for the rest of the time. Reunited with his family. The brothers have changed. That's the kind of story we all want the ending of. But the message all the way along is he's doing what's right, but there's these strong times of oppression that he has to sort out. Is God for me, against me? Do I react positively, negatively? Do I give up hope? Do I not? And each time he chooses to come out of it. He had something in him that was guiding, giving him promptings, helping him know what to do in his job, that God could bless the people, how to handle tough situations that were coming. He had a gift. You don't have that level of integrity and success without having some extra things falling your way. Then you switch over to Jezebel. She already has a bad reputation when it just says, Ahab did more evil than any of the kings that had ever come before him. This is 1 Kings 16. I believe it's verse 31. Oh, no, it's not, but it's somewhere there. Oh, yeah, he's done, it's 30. Oh, yeah, it is 30 and 31. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. So this guy already was one of the worst, so now he's doing all that, and that's so bad. Not only that, but now the big one, right? Whoa, he not only did this, but what is it? Oh, he married Jezebel. Whoa, he can commit all these horrific crimes against all of humanity, but then Jezebel, now that's over the top. So that's kind of a bad reputation. I think so. But then every time she's mentioned again, there's something that happens first that she could have had a change of thought. The next time she's mentioned is the mega famous one. Elijah has already had the no rain, 3 years, comes out of hiding, challenges them to the big showdown. And the prophets go all day. And by the way, are the prophets really crazy? Because I think that's the way we pitch it a lot, you know. Why are you dancing around cutting yourselves all day? Your God's not real. But if you look at lots of the stories that we hear in other parts of the Old Testament, it does appear that they did have a supernatural power usually. Demons, Satan, however it works, they were able to do things traditionally that were supernatural. We see the same thing in the story of Moses. They have a power to do things that is actually supernatural, and that's why they laugh at Moses at first. Like, our gods can do that too. So apparently Satan had the ability to do this, so why would these prophets even accept a showdown if they're all fakers, right? If they're like, hey, we don't actually have power, we're just trying to get money. A showdown in front of all the people? I don't think so. Against the one guy that everyone wants to kill anyway? Why would you go there? Again, it appears to me from the other Bible stories in the context that they actually did think that they were going to be able to have fire come down from heaven, that they'd had similar things happen before. So they're actually ready for the showdown. Bring it on. Why do you think we've been so successful? Why are there 500 of us, 450? And yet, the altar is consumed. The power is stopped. The people are killed. And yet Jezebel hears the whole story. Not even an ounce of fear. Not an ounce of respect for what just happened. Just, fine, you killed my prophets, but now I'm going to kill you. And Elijah, after the big showdown, is like, no, runs away. So there's Jezebel again. She's had this presentation, this long story about the immensity of the miracle, the public display of the miracle, an overt time where it's shown that she, her group does not have power and that God has immense power. The stones were burned up. The reason you use stones is so that they don't get burned up. That is amazing. She has, Ahab wants that vineyard. She has the guy killed, Naboth's vineyard. Has Naboth killed? A prophet comes and says, this is what's going to happen to you because of it. All those things come true. Point by point. And she knows about it. And when they come to get her, she sits smugly, does herself up, and starts mouthing off to them from the thing. It actually calls them a different name. If you find out, if you go back and look through the Bible what that name was, it's actually the name of a person who had betrayed his king so that he could have his own power later. So she's directly referring to the fact, I know you already killed the king. I know you're coming here to try and take over and have power. But she's mouthing off to him even still, last second. So you have these two characters that are given immense portions of time out of the whole story. And one of them, it's shown how much hit him. And yet he followed the decisions to do what's right. And someone that had immense portions of time where huge portions of it is spent telling you all the opportunities she had to learn her lesson and believe, to stop doing some of this stuff, and refused. There's a story just in that alone. There's a story about what miracles can do and what they can't do. She didn't care what just happened. Wasn't a miracle to her. Doesn't matter. Joseph has these horrific things happen to him. It's not a sign that he's not loved by God or that he's off track or that he should have just slept with the lady or that God is punishing him. He doesn't take it that way. He just believes that God knows what he's doing. And he keeps stepping. And he believes, apparently by his actions, that the way he lives life is the story, not what comes of it. Him staying out of prison wasn't what told the story of God. It was him doing what he was supposed to. The way he lived that told the story of God, despite the outcome. We see the same thing with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? Our God can save us, but the outcome isn't what we're saying is going to be the miracle. The miracle is that we're doing this. That's the important thing, is that we're doing it. We know it's right. We're going to do it, even if it costs us our lives. In that case, they are saved. But there's a point where the things you're going through, no matter how bad or how good, are meant in and of themselves to tell a story despite the result. It's not always a victory. It's not always defeat. No matter how good it looks, it might still come to ruin. No matter how bad it looks, it might still have a miracle. We don't know. Instead, we have a chance to look back and say that our lives have led to something. I remember at one point sitting with a student that I had at one of my jobs. He had already sliced a couple of other kids with a razor blade and a nail. Was threatening to do more. Had sliced the insides of his lips so that blood was just pouring out of his mouth. And was sitting in the side of the room like doing these deep breaths. Most of the people, of course, were on the other side of the room. So I walk in. I knew kids like that. I hung out with tons of kids like that. I have good ideas about what's shaping it, what's not, what the dangers are, what's not. And I had this feeling that I'm meant to go deal closely with him. Police were already on their way. But I knew that I was meant to go closely. So first of all, the terrible events that I had gone through before, these terrible things when I was in the situations as a kid, thinking, why on earth have I ever been put in this type of situation? Now make this something that's doable, first of all, for me. But secondly, I then hear the prompting and I understand it. It makes sense to me. And so I pull up a chair and I scoot within 2 inches of his face. Easily within range of the nail and the thing, and he says, you should be scared of me. I said, okay, I should be scared of you, but I'm not. Do I look scared? No. You know the police are coming, right? Yes. Was it worth it? Was what worth it? Well, whatever you're trying to accomplish. You know, so you're bleeding from the mouth and you've scared other people. Was it worth it? I don't know. Well, you think about that. The sheriff's department, I hear him driving in right now. So in walk the sheriffs, hands on the guns. Everyone out of the room by this point. And they tell him, drop your weapons. 4-inch nail, razor blade. Drop your weapons. And he clenches them tighter and clenches up. And he says, I don't have to listen to you. And I leaned in and I pressed my forehead against his forehead. We're sitting in chairs. Pressed my forehead against his forehead. Said, is this worth it? And in a way, I don't like it. Makes me feel cross-eyed to think of it now, but he locked eyes with me. I saw him look right into my eyes. And he just puts them in a hand, holds them up. Please take it out. Take him away. Not a good situation. And yet, my experiences made me ready for that. It wasn't a problem to me. I mean, it was a problem. But in terms of my direct role at that moment, that part wasn't a problem. When I got the prompting, go, you're, deal closely. Get in close. Show comfort. Show trust. Do it. It wasn't like, oh, but he's really scary. It was like, I knew a guy like that once. One of my best friends. Close. I remember another time sitting in an office with a student that I personally believe was having, like, had been taken over by a spirit. Whether people believe in that anymore or not, I hear people debate that even in the churches. I still believe in it. And in this case, if I spent the time to set up the story to tell you why I think it, I can tell you. I had just heard a story from my sister who was in South America, and somebody in the village had gotten demon-possessed, just flailing about on the grounds, all this stuff, and one of the local pastors or someone that was a spiritual person in the area walked up to him, cast out the demon. And the person stopped driving, looked at him and says, Hugh, you're trying to talk to us? Do you want me to tell what you've done? You're one of us. So I'm sitting there in my office with this thinking, so what do? Where am I at? Am I able to handle this? But I had this friend. I had a friend that was heavily into all this stuff. Seances and all this stuff. Stories I can tell about the supernatural things I watched happen over and over that leave no question in my personal mind about the fact that there is a supernatural power and a power for evil. I know what happens in the heart. I know what's happening in my heart. I know what the difference is, regardless of the fact that, yeah, I don't have the strength. I'm weak. I do bad things. I think bad things. I avoid things I'm supposed to do. I tell kids who need spiritual guidance I don't want to meet with them because they're goody-goodies. You know, my first story. Ugh. This guy's coming into my room. I don't want to talk to you. I'm trying to avoid you so I can go do real stuff. That's me, right? That's who I am. Can I sit and contend and hold out if someone actually has a demon possession? No. But I also know that I had a prompting to do it, which means God's with me and he can. I'm prepared for that. Not because I'm strong enough, just because I went through the stories to where I get it. I already get it. What if the reason we go through the hardest times is not because God's doing it to us or not doing it to us. We don't know how that all works. But because it is happening, it's part of the world. It happens to people. But that we have a story we can tell. We have something in the future that we will be able to make a difference in. And maybe it's here. Maybe it's in that situation. Maybe victory is coming and you can fix it because of what you're standing and being willing to stay and do that. Being willing to stay respectful and loving. And trust that feeling you have about what's right. Maybe it's not going to work out, but your story still matters to 100 other people. It's one of the things in the book, The Great Controversy, Ellen White says. She says that it was the blood of the martyrs that sprang up new believers everywhere. For every drop of blood spilt, a new group of people who believed sprang up. How could people sit and watch as someone is told, you're evil. You're violating everything the church believes. You're taken over by an evil spirit, and they're angry and yelling, and they're dragging them to be killed, and that person's peaceful, singing. Doesn't that create a pretty direct comparison for you about what's really evil and what's really good, if you're paying attention at all? And from that, people would watch that happen, and people who before weren't sure Maybe we're uncomfortable with it. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they're fine with it. They watch what happens, and a new faith springs up in them. A new willingness to stand themselves springs up in them because of what they saw happen. What if the challenges we go through are not about the actual result of the circumstances, they're about the story? I had the chance last year, or maybe 2 years ago, I don't remember the exact timing, to meet someone that's probably been one of the biggest change agents in my life. Bernie actually had a meeting to go with a group of pastors in the area to meet this guy first. He was then doing tours and speaking for the rest of the week. Bernie calls me at like 12:15 and says, "Hey, there's a lunch. It already started, but the guy's speaking in 10 minutes. There's an extra seat. Come join me. Free lunch. I'm coming." So I slipped out, raced over there, got there, didn't even get the lunch because it was already served and done, and the guy started talking. His name's Nick Vujicic, and some of you may have seen him while he's here. You might have seen him on YouTube or elsewhere. But he was born with no arms and no legs. And the intro that was given about him started talking about how China asked him to come do speeches there, to do talk. They have a huge, I think it's like 200,000 people that are going to come. And his entire message is entirely evangelistic. He only tells about God and what God does. China, government, asking him to come speak. Why? I don't know. So I was already a little intrigued. I think it was like only the fourth person that's not LDS that was actually asked to speak in the tabernacle and had, just thousands and thousands of people there. There's all these stories he has. 200,000 men in South Africa, joint mixed race, coming together so they can hear him speak. Just truly making a huge difference in the world. And when he talked, it hit straight into my heart. And as I thought about this, what's been on my heart recently, the struggles, the challenges, the feelings of no matter how much we try to do what's right, there's times when you still just get stopped or at least delayed. Things feel like, wait, what's happening? I had the chance to hear that talk and then go up at the end. He has everyone come up and hug him that wants to. I've had him hug me. I've had him say, "I love you," like you see him say there. He says it to each person. But I've also stood in line and watched as half or three-fourths of people standing in line are crying like you saw in some of those. And looking back, the one that's the most surprising is when there's 30 pastors that are leading the organization. When they're the ones going up there broken down like that, you see what's happening in them. You know, they're the leaders. They're the ones trying to do what's right and lead in that strong way, but they have the same hurts and pains. But having him hug me and tell me that, hearing his story, at the time, it literally flashed me back to that first time that I had the first time where I made a difference for someone in some type of similar way in that dorm room when I didn't even want it. And when the tears were still flowing and he gave me a hug, and when I prayed with him when I didn't even think I could do such a thing. It's not in the result. It's in how you live out what you're a part of. It's in your choices. And I really believe that. Let's pray. God, we know that life for probably each person here has its challenges. Everyone faces times when they feel pushed by circumstances or challenged by people or boxed in by structures. They feel like maybe hope is dwindling or that evil has won. And you also know that we each have times in life that we have seen and experienced miracles. Experienced times when joy is alive and well in our souls and where things seem to be going well. As we see in Nick, as we saw with Joseph and Jezebel, both things happen to everybody. But we have choices on how we respond to each one and how we live it out so that we can then be light and security and stability to others, where we can feel that sense of purpose regardless of our circumstance. And I just pray that for every person here, for every situation represented, that you help us to understand that our circumstances can shape our hearts. Your promptings, even in the hardest times, can turn us into people that can make a difference, and that we can have joy in the challenge. And for most of us, that probably feels like it'll require supernatural. And I just pray that you do that for us and in us. You help us to be examples for others, and you help us to understand the purpose that we can each have. The idea that even if someone else is being unjust, we are given the chance to change our hearts to show your love out from us. Thank you for that. Thank you for drawing so near as to be able to touch individual lives, to heal hearts. We just pray that you do it today. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Wasatch Hills Church Podcast. For information about the Wasatch Hills Church, please visit us on the internet at www.wasatchhills.org, or you may email Pastor Bernie Anderson at pastor@wasatchhills.org.